Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The book, Frankly, We Did Win This Election, went on sale yesterday, although it's probably received more pre-publication buzz than almost any of the books that are out there right now. And we're very fortunate to have the author, Michael Bender, who's a senior White House reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, Michael. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Charlie. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, the subhead of this is the inside story of how Trump lost, and we have to get to this, but you have one of the more interesting blurbs on the book that I had to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
You have a blurb from Donald Trump, 45th president of the United States, who says who says of you, Michael, he's one of the tough ones, but such beautiful hair. So what's that?
Well, that is really the kind of heart of the relationship between Donald Trump and I. He appreciates, I work for the Wall Street Journal, he appreciates the journal. And, I've interviewed him in Trump Tower, on Air Force One, and in the Oval Office. But what really matters to him is my hair. And at one point, you remember when Sean Spicer was having some trouble and they were trying to replace him? And we were talking to him on Air Force, the president on Air Force One, and he said, well, I can have anyone I want work in that job. You know, I have the pick of the litter. And my eyebrows kind of furled, and Trump can pick up on, you know, I mean, he reads a room better than anyone, right? And he swirled around to me and said, what, you disagree? He says, you would take that job. I said, no, Mr. President, I would not take that job. And he looked at me and said, well, with that hair, you need to be the press secretary. And so it's come up in several instances. We can talk about it a little bit more if you want to, but he's attacked my book. He singled out this book specifically several times now. And, I kind of just count my blessings that he's not disparaging my hair, because then I know we know something's really wrong.
That would be the end of a beautiful relationship. So did I notice that you have six younger sisters?
Yes, that's right. I am.
Does that help you growing up in a family like that? Does that help you cover the White House? I mean, you have experience managing chaos or surviving it? I'm just wondering. That seemed like an unusual little detail.
Yeah, definitely. It's a big family for sure. I think it's helped me in so many different aspects of my life, honestly. You sort of figure out how to make your voice heard, when to, kind of what battles to pick, what not,
get along with different dynamics.
Exactly. That's exactly right. How to operate within a group, and keep everybody happy. So, definitely covering the Trump White House was more when, because I had to babysit a lot of my sisters. I was the oldest of seven.
I see.
So that particularly
was preparation.
Correct. Yeah.
See, I'm in awe of that, being an only child myself. And by the way, it was only like 10 minutes ago that I realized that you're married to Ashley Parker, who is the, White House bureau chief for the Washington Post. So you guys don't have any shortage of things to talk about, do you?
No, that's right. In fact, that's how most people know me, as Ashley Parker's husband, which is great. I mean, she's wonderful. She's the best. We can talk about all of this stuff in politics in Washington. She's, much better reporter and writer than me. She's my best editor, my best advisor, my best friend. I'm very, very lucky.
Well, it's funny. I saw it on her Twitter feed. She had your very young children posing with copies of your book, but I didn't realize it was your children. I thought, hey, this is really nice for, the Washington Post reporter to be really promoting a book by a Wall Street. I mean, what a nice person Ashley Parker is, which of course she is.
So let's Midwestern optimism is coming out there, Charlie.
So we are Midwesterners. So let's talk about how these books come together, because there's a number of them that are mm-hmm. out, and they are all incredibly sourced. Part of the fascination of reading these stories is to realize that you are in the room, because people in the room decided to share this with you. And you have an interesting note right near the beginning of the book where you talk mm-hmm. about who talked to you, who was willing to talk to you, and that you understand that many of them give interviews to authors because they're being protective, because they know that they have to tell the story first, their version, to protect themselves against stories that other people might tell. I mean, that's part of the dynamic of this, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are... it's interesting. A lot of people, a lot of colleagues in this business think it's in one sense easy to cover an administration like Trump, because there are so many people willing to talk in so many ways into the administration. But in a lot of ways, it makes it harder because there is no, or I should say just as hard as covering a more traditional administration, because there is no sort of single voice, right? They're usually in an Obama administration or a George W. Bush administration, if they had a meeting, there usually aren't a dozen different versions of that meeting from people coming out of it. But the only real way to get to the truth, you can have a source, you can talk to, you know, is talking to every person you can. And you brought up Ashley and her good reporting. She's kind of trademarked these lines in her stories about, you know, the dozens of people that they talk to, administration mm-hmm. officials, Republicans, Trump friends. And that's the only way to begin feeling comfortable with what actually happened inside the room, whether it's the Trump campaign, inside the Oval Office, or, you know, Mar-a-Lago or Bedminster.
So you set out to write this book about the campaign, which turned out to be very, very different than mm-hmm. what anyone expected, including you. And that whole year, and I guess, you know, part of the delight of reading the book is we know what happened, but just to sit back and realize all the things that happened in one year, how Donald Trump became the first incumbent in three decades to lose re-election and the only one whose defeat culminated in a violent insurrection, as you write. One thing that strikes me about the book is that Donald Trump, and you tell me whether I'm right about this, that, mm-hmm. that Donald Trump doesn't believe, one of the reasons why he believes the big lie or pushes the big lies is that he doesn't believe, he has a hard time believing that he lost the election because he couldn't believe that he could lose to Joe Biden. He just could not, and this comes up again and again, including, you know, his comments, you have comments that he made about Joe Biden's bad facelift. I mean, he was mm-hmm. obsessed with the fact that I cannot lose to this guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a good question and one I struggled with during covering the administration and writing the book. I mean, I don't have to tell you. I mean, he was impeached, be clear here, the first time because he was going after Joe Biden, right? I mean, it was a pursuit of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden that trying to damage him politically. That led to his first impeachment, you know, in the first place. So it's hard for me to understand how he gets to a place just a few months later where he's, you know, dismissing Joe Biden as a quote unquote mental retard in the Oval Office. I mean, he interrupted a policy meeting in the Oval Office for a total non sequitur about that he couldn't believe he could be losing to a mental retard in the polls like that. I don't know how much it was about Joe Biden. I don't know if there's anyone in the Democratic field he would have felt like, you know, he deserved to lose to. So I think this was a way of him ultimately talking himself into the place we got by January 6th, which is what really he'd been telling the country for 5 years, right? That he mm-hmm. that Trump was never wrong. No other politicians were to be believed. The courts were not right. He would always be acquitted and he would never fade away.
So let's stick with this because as you remind us, he was, it seems so long ago, doesn't it? That first impeachment about mm-hmm. the attempt to get the Ukrainian government to investigate Biden and particularly Hunter Biden. You have a very interesting chapter in the book, I mean, a passage in the book where you talk about your own role later mm-hmm. on when the Trump folks were really trying to push this Hunter Biden story. I mean, they really did think that this was still, after everything, was kind of their magic bullet. And they were really, really hoping that reporters, including you, would break this. So tell me a little, just tell us a little bit about that story, because that really was a very, very interesting little moment in this campaign.
I appreciate that. I think that's definitely one of the scenes and chapters that, I mean, you're not going to find that in any of these other Trump books. And I do think this book actually is the only one to date that looks at Trump through his campaign, through his administration. And I spent a lot of time with his supporters. Yeah. The bookends of this are that it goes from impeachment to impeachment. And the through line through one of the through lines through this whole thing is Hunter Biden. It's in the last weeks of the race, really. And, you know, I've been covering Trump for 5 years. I know a lot of the people who have, you know, most of the people in Trump world have somewhat of relationships with just about all of them. And, you know, a certain amount of trust between the, you know, between us, some professional relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And they were beside themselves, and partly correctly here, that the Hunter Biden stuff story had been completely ignored by anything other than the right-wing media. And their frustration was that as long as the far-right media continued to cover this Hunter Biden issue, what he was doing overseas, his international business dealings, whether or not his father was involved, how much he was trading on the family name, which are all fair questions, right, for any politician of any party. But they couldn't get any coverage because, in part, the right wing media had distorted it so badly that it was viewed as basically a conspiracy by everybody else. Yes. So what they were trying to do was bring it to the Wall Street Journal, bring it to me, and say, hey, you know, we think we have a story here. And what they brought to me was a man by the name of Tony Bobulinski. Mm-hmm. You know, I met with him and his attorneys for several hours. They walked me through all of his text messages. I mean, he, as a journal reporter, as a Wall Street Journal reporter, it was a fascinating, rare, I thought, under the hood look at international deal making at really an embryonic level, ambitious young businessmen from the world's two biggest superpowers, talking about the U.S. and China, and how they're both trying to woo each other and get a deal, and kind of what you could see signs of who wanted what, and you know, Joe Biden's name does come up here and there, but I ended those meetings hours long saying just what I told you. There is a good story here. It's about Hunter Biden. Everything you've showed me about Joe Biden is not the smoking gun you think it is. It's worth questions, sure, but you know, we're not going to do a story based on this that Joe Biden has done something improper because it just doesn't show it. And to my surprise, they said, sure, like, no, you do it. They wanted anything, they wanted the imprimatur of the Wall Street Journal's rigorous editing process to say, at least there's something here, that is worth talking about. And, you know, Hunter Biden, I'm going to use this phrase a little loosely here, but he has traded on the family name for decades. Yeah. You know, it is worth looking at. And again, it was like a John Grisham style details here of this back and forth with him and some Chinese officials. But, you know, what happened is what happens always in Trump world is that the left hand's not talking to the right hand. And it all falls apart when Trump blurts out on a call with reporters that the Wall Street Journal is working on this story. And then it forced our hand, and we ended up having to write the story that these guys did not want, which was that based on this evidence, Joe Biden didn't have any involvement.
So this is interesting that the most, you know, perhaps the most consequential story that you wrote was a story about basically the story that you didn't write, the story that they wanted you to write that you said wasn't a story. I put that in the most convoluted possible way, but I think you understand what I'm saying. Is that most reporters think that, you know, the most important thing I will do is when I break this big scandal, and your most important story was the one that said, yeah, there's not a big scandal here.
Yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily the story I wanted to do, not because for any political reason, but sure. Like there, you know, that something didn't happen is not really news, you know, usually. There was something here interesting. I thought there was, you know, maybe I mentioned Midwestern optimism. Maybe it was my own Midwestern optimism that thought this was actually could actually happen. And I should have been probably smart enough to realize right then that this was all going to blow up in all of our faces within just a matter of days. Because what happened, as you'll remember, the New York Post basically posted the contents of the quote unquote Hunter Biden laptop.
Right. As badly as possible.
Yeah. So I remember that night I got a call from Steve Bannon, who was on that operation with Giuliani. And Bannon was just, urgent call from Steve. He says, you know, what's this about? You're working on a story. I've been told you've got a team of two dozen Wall Street Journal reporters and you're going to post a front page story in 2 days. And that's when I was just like, oh, shit. Right. Like, you know, I knew that someone was overinflating what I was doing in order to try to halt the Bannon and Giuliani operation. And it was right then where I knew that, you know, I'd gotten myself into trouble, and some of our good business reporters and China reporters who I dragged into this. And, sure. You know, I make a special acknowledgement in the book, or really an apology in the acknowledgements for embroiling those guys.
See, this raises the question, you know, then I remember that the New York Post story was written by somebody who, you know, didn't really actually write the story. They slapped somebody's byline on, and it sort of became an example of bad journalism, which raises the question. If in fact you did have, if the right-wing media had not toxified this story, if they had taken that laptop story seriously, if it had been vetted more carefully, more honestly, more professionally, you know, might it have been a bigger story? Might it have raised other questions that got sloughed over during the campaign, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, very possibly, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons journalists do stories a lot of times is there's a decent story here, and you put, or maybe not the reason you do stories, but often what happens, right? You do a sort of an interesting story that, you know, a string gets pulled, someone sees it, gives you another piece of information, and that kind of stuff builds on each other. I mean, it's two things are striking to me here. One is that, again, this is one of the strings through Trump's last, you know, 20 months in office is this issue. And the story I'm telling you now happened in the final weeks of the race. I mean, they had a year plus to try to sort this out. And, you know, I mean, how many months did we talk about whether Hunter Biden was going to go on the stand in the Senate for that impeachment trial? I mean, there's just so much time wasted that they will never get back. And, you know, when you talk about vetting the story, the other thing that struck me, I mean, I've been in the business for 24 years. My first job was a small community paper in Grand Junction, Colorado. You know, I've worked in Ohio and in Florida before I came to DC. You know, the industry has changed so much in those 20 years. And that's what I realized there too, because the journal's always had a reputation for this kind of rigorous editing and reporting and kind of, you know, just the facts, ma'am type of reports in our news pages. But if you want to get a story vetted, if you want that kind of, you know, attention and focus and rigor given to a story, if you want something that you know, readers will look at on both sides of the aisle and say, okay, there might be something here. Where else do you take it? The fact that the laptop landed in the New York Post. I mean, the New York Post has always been, you know, had its own special brand, but I don't think that laptop would have just run in the Post 2 decades ago, right? I mean, it's a little troubling as a newspaper reporter and a journalist
it didn't work out as a strategy. So let's talk about probably one of the more dramatic elements of your book that got a lot of attention when it was excerpted, the whole role of General Milley in pushing back. And he's a major character in this book, and you really realize the difficult situation that the general had, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But the scene where, and people might be familiar with it because it was excerpted, where they're sitting in the Oval Office and they're talking about the idea of invoking the Insurrection Act, bringing in troops. Weirdly enough, Mike Pence floated this idea, and you had Stephen Miller, of course, there, the anti-immigration homunculus, you know, talking about the need to, you know, send in troops, and General Milley turning around and saying, "Shut the fuck up, Stephen." So because that really was a central part of the year is this of the whole story, this push and pull between the military, the Department of Defense, and the constant obsession the Trump world had with the role of the military, not just in putting down, not just in putting down the riots, but then later in, could they play a role in overturning the election?
Yeah, this is one of the themes of the book here, and I think a powerful example of how the people around Trump, you know, it wasn't that they were concerned about chaos. I mean, what revealed itself in my interviews with, senior administration officials and campaign officials was that they were worried that Trump was so desperate to hold on to office that he'd become violent and reckless and unhinged. And it fell to the top general in the world's most powerful military to act as a guardrail to prevent some truly dangerous situations, which is the one you brought up. Which is the one you brought up here. And you know, so much was reported about this at the time, but what we didn't really know or hear from was Milley's role back then. And the reporting in this book shows, I think, there's instance after instance of Milley really being the one who's willing to say no to Trump in a clear and precise way. That almost no one else around Trump does.
Yeah, including the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who was known as Yesper, really did find his voice after the whole Lafayette Square clearing, which is kind of interesting, is that for a lot of these guys, there was a line. We always wondered, was there a line? You know, what would they do if they crossed it? And I have to admit that I was surprised at the time that Mark Esper pushed back.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought up Esper, because you're right. Esper was one; he was unequivocal about about bringing military troops into U.S. cities. Esper was one of the men in the room, men and women in the room, who understood the clear difference between National Guardsmen, who are trained as quasi law enforcement to handle protests, and the young men and women of the 81st Airborne, who are trained to kill and take land. Right. And the sort of different dynamics that those two present, but the problem with Esper was that that Trump had kind of turned on Esper by then, and was very dismissive of him, in that very special Trump way. But Milley, in June of 2020, has a rapport with Trump where he can tell him no, and Trump still, Trump still respects him. Several aides told me that. That Milley had a good way of interacting with Trump, and that he could tell him no directly and clearly. But then, a few minutes later, Trump has something on his mind. Says, "Get me Milley. What does Milley think about this? Find me Milley." And it's not really until Milley has to apologize for being tricked into the photo op at St. John's where things start to fray. And it's another scene in the book here where Trump confronts Milley in front of other people and says, "Why did you apologize? I don't understand that. You look weak." And Milley looks at Trump and says, "I didn't expect you would understand." Yeah, and then that's really their relationship starts to fray for good.
Well, also you make it very clear though that he's a tough guy, that he's not a shrinking flower. He wasn't like a lot of the other aides who'd be sitting around who'd be cowed by the president, that his strength was his willingness to push back, to bark back, and we were fortunate that he was there. But one of the really valuable things that I found from your book, and by the way, the book again is Frankly We Did Win This Election: The Inside Story of How Trump Lost, is you spent a lot of time with the rally goers, the Trump super fans. And this is something that a lot of us have a hard time understanding: who these people are, what motivates them. And you found some people who were, passionate. You sort of embedded with some of these folks and followed them all the way to the bitter end. So who are these people?
Well, this is really the human angle of the book. Really very quickly, the way this started was, you remember Trump kicked off, quote unquote, his campaign back in June of 2019, and he brought hundreds of reporters down there. This was the big launch of the re-election, and it was the same exact rally that I had sat through dozens and dozens of times before. And I was pissed. Right? We went all the way down there. There was nothing new. The sound system was a little louder. Right, the stage was a little bit bigger, but it was, there were locker up chants, build the wall chants, right, and there was no second term, nothing, no new message,
just playing the hits.
Yeah, I was like, I got duped here, but then I sat back, and it's a 20,000 seat arena, and every seat was filled with people who'd been waiting hours, if not days. They were all participating vigorously in the chants. They knew this was the show they were going to get, and that's what they wanted to see. And it occurred to me that. What is it about them or about this president that made them want to watch this rerun over and over again? So I spent the next couple of years trying to understand them. You know, instead of walking up and getting a quick quote of, you know, that they that AOC was a Muslim or some other sort of shocking, you know, wild quote, I wanted to find out who these people were as people. And what I found was that the people who traveled around, that their lives had become bigger with Trump and richer mm-hmm. with Trump. And stay with me here. But, you know, these are folks who, if you have time to go to 50 rallies for Trump, you know, you didn't have a family, or you're estranged from your family, or you're recently retired and looking for something to fill. I mean, that's who these folks were. And they found that community. They stayed at each other's houses, on the drive from Connecticut to Cincinnati, you know, staying at Becky's farm in Northeast Ohio to split up the trip. You know, I met a couple who had met on the trail and, you know, married and since divorced. But, you know, it gave them a sense of purpose. And for Trump, it was he said things in a way that empowered them. A lot of ways. Yeah. One woman I follow quite a bit is Sandra Kaczynski, who tells me that, mm-hmm. you know, 5 years ago, she would have paid her Obamacare fine and moved on and griped about it. But like Trump had told her, you know, that she didn't have to pay the fine. And so she didn't. And, you know, in her words, nothing happened.
And you know, she felt free and powerful.
Yeah. And that,
I was struck mm-hmm. by that.
Yeah, and even and beyond politics, she's a Walmart worker in a patio and garden department, and you know, now tells her boss like what her schedule is instead of the other way around, and speaks up for herself. And there's a lot of things that are hard to understand, but there's a lot of, I think, endearing. I mean, the human aspects of this that you know, at the end is frankly just heartbreaking. They're really misled at the end.
Yeah, well, let's go to that, because mm-hmm. so what did she think that January 6th was all about? What did she think was going to happen on January 6th?
I mean, by the end of 2020, Sandra's traveled more than she ever has in her whole life. And yes, in 2020, the year of the pandemic, when we were all locked down, she was earning frequent flyer miles, right? her friend Ben Hirschman had one of these rally goers had died of COVID. Randall, another member of this community, overweight, a smoker in his 60s, knew the risks, acutely knew the risks. And when he became so sick, but he refused to go to the hospital because he didn't want to add to Trump's numbers, not just the positive numbers, but the number of people tested. He was putting his own health on the line. And Sandra, she gets to January 6th. She's basically turned off Fox News. It had been the background music in her daily routine. But when Fox called the election and, you know, in her eyes turned against Trump, she had become, her world became smaller again, basically, Charlie. In a kind of vortex of conservative news where again, like Trump's kind of gaslighting was a reality, and that Trump was never going to be wrong, and he had obviously won. She told me she knew that Trump had won and that it was a fraud because Corey Lewandowski had told her so. She had run into Corey in the summer of 2020 at the Republican National Convention, again during the pandemic, where there was no public event. She crashed an event at the Trump Hotel, you know, cornered Corey. They were talking, and Corey told her, according to her, that the only way Trump was going to lose in November is if there's massive election fraud. Mm-hmm. And Trump and Corey, you know, in these folks' eyes, is sort of a prophet of an Old Testament style prophet in Trump world. And it was all playing out exactly how they'd been, you know, had been foretold.
Well, you tell the story of January 6th mm-hmm. when they are there, and then they hear the word that Mike Pence is not going to pull that bizarre thing of not counting the election. And is it Sandra? I don't have it right in front of me, but was her who said so? You describe how the surge, the energy in the crowd intensified as they began looking for Mike Pence. And if they had found Mike Pence, she says, they would have killed him.
That's right.
I mean, that's a hell of a quote.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's chilling. I mean, she this is that's a very good detail of, to understand what I was trying to say before, which was that of her news inputs, right, of where she's getting her information. A lot of us knew what Pence was going to do. He had not put out a statement, but there was a lot of reporting in the mainstream press that Pence was telling Trump that this was unconstitutional. But he hadn't put out a statement. It hadn't come out of his mouth. And the VP is waiting to, show as a sign of respect, waiting for Trump to finish his speech before they put it out. Well, not until Pence's statement goes out do a lot of the people at the rally realize what's happening, that Pence, has in their minds has now suddenly turned, right? Because Trump had been telling them for the last several weeks that Pence was going to do this, or was probably going to do this, or there was a real possibility that he would.
I'll be honest with you. I did not understand until afterwards that people really believe this was a real possibility. This is a detail. We've realized it since, and your book makes it very, very clear. But remember when you first heard the idea, the notion that the vice president could simply not count the electoral votes? You rolled your eyes, right? Yeah. And yet what's very clear is that these people believe this. They had been told that this was a real possibility and that this was going to happen, which explains the shock when it didn't.
Yeah, and they were taking it very literally and very seriously along the way. And they saw things that a lot of the rest of us didn't. I mean, the people who were around Trump Trump's been telling us this for 5 years, that the only way he could lose was an election fraud. I mean, the book actually goes back quite a bit and to show how he has done this for decades, right? I mean, when his when The Apprentice was losing, was coming in second or third place or not winning Emmys, he claimed voter fraud.
Right.
There was a real lack of imagination, especially around Trump. And so many people told me that he just needs some space. He'll get there himself. He seems okay. The fact that he wasn't screaming and frothing at the mouth somehow to the Mike Pences of the world, the Ronald McDaniels of the world, the Jared Kushners of the world, suggested that he was going to somehow get to yes on this, even though he'd been promising us otherwise all along. And giving him space, really, it only created an opening for Giuliani, Sidney Powell's and those characters, right? And Mike Pompeo's words, the crazies had taken over.
So you quote this woman as saying that if we had found Mike Pence, we would have killed him. And she doesn't mean that metaphorically or symbolically. I mean, she's talking about how angry people were. It was also interesting that hours and hours and hours later, when Trump put out the video where he told people to leave, you're wonderful people, I love you. She found that to be, she was disappointed in that.
Yeah.
That was a letdown for her. And I think that reading this is also, underlies why Trump refuses to acknowledge or concede, because he understands that his base, people like these super fans, would feel tremendously betrayed and let down. And so does she feel let down? What does she think is going to happen now?
Well, it's a good question. I do want to be clear that Sondra did not storm the Capitol. She was in the sort of parade toward the Capitol. She was outside the rest of the time. I think that is a fair line of distinction. I just kind of want to make. And Trump's lack of nuance on any issue for anything had become so ingrained with these with the base that was confusing. She was in Cleveland for his rally in June. She's been down to Florida. Trump has started holding fundraisers for different organizations at Mar-a-Lago. She's on those email lists, and she goes and pays the money to go to the fundraiser for the chance to see Trump. And this is some new reporting after the book. I haven't talked about anywhere, but one of these fundraisers, she kind of stuck around afterward and knew that he was golfing that day, and told her friend that if we're kind of the last ones out, maybe we'll see him coming in on his golf cart. And again, she's been to 60, 70 rallies at this point, in the front row all the time, and it works. And they're at the valet stand when Trump's golf cart pulls up, and he gets out and kind of starts to walk into the back entrance, and she just goes for it and yells out, "Trump!" And he turns to her, sees her, looks at her and says, "Do you work here?" So
interesting.
Yeah.
Draw that time. So actually, Ray, at the very end of the book, you do describe how Donald Trump lives now. You went down to Mar-a-Lago to interview him. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a surreal scene. The ex-president holding court at the country club he lives in. He's the only person who lives in the country club. And so what is his life like now? It seems that, I mean, he's surrounded by adoring fans. They have dinner, you know, in a roped off area. He invited you to dinner and everything. So how does Donald Trump live these days?
Yeah. Yeah. I caught him in an interesting time period for sure. Although, you know, with Donald Trump, maybe any time qualifies as an interesting time period for Donald Trump, but he was just as unprepared for post-presidency life as he was for the presidency itself. He arrived in Mar-a-Lago and turned to an aide and said, well, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do all day now? The staff that he had with him, he brought to a room to show where they were going to work out of an office in Mar-a-Lago. There were mattresses on the floor. They had to go and, the Office Depot and buy their desks and chairs. And Trump was in a weirdly, there was a moment there where he was in this weird reflective, weird for Trump and unusual for Trump, melancholy. But he's since found his routine. He golfs all the time, not surprisingly, sometimes 36 holes a day. When I interviewed him the first time, he had just finished playing with Ernie Els. It looked to me like he had lost a little bit of weight. His hair had returned to a color that resembled something, might actually be found in nature. He looked good. He was very relaxed. He was in an upright chair, but he was essentially reclined in it. I mean, he was kind of slouched in the chair, it relaxed. Right. And, he's at a point here where he kind of always is. Is he going to run for president? I don't think he knows. But he does want to be part of the conversation. And you
asked him about how he felt about deplatforming, and it was a kind of a surprising answer, right? I mean, what is it like to be off Twitter? He doesn't seem to mind.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe this is my own lack of imagination here, but I'm continually surprised covering Donald Trump, and I almost fell off the couch when he told me that he was glad to be off Twitter because he'd realized how much time he had, what a time suck. Scrolling through Twitter was, and how much trouble you'd get into retweeting people.
I love that, buddy. It's the retweeting that gets you in trouble. Yeah. That's what kills you. It's the retweets, but don't we all know that?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. This is sort of like the danger of Donald Trump. There's always a kernel of truth in what he's saying. He's not wrong on that.
So, do you think he's going to run?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I do think. I do think 2022. I mean, he's already made what, 24 endorsements everything from the U.S. Senate to, I believe, the Staten Island borough president, and and I'm sure he's just going to make more. And how those some of those races pan out will be informative to him. Especially where he's endorsing candidates in primaries, running against incumbents. Those are not easy races to win, even when you have the endorsement of a former president. So that'll be, I think that'll be informative. But what I do think is that there's a lot of Republicans have a choice in 2022, and it's going to be whether or not they want to try to redefine themselves post-Trump. And not only will that play into Trump's decision to a degree, but I think what this book does is lay out in a very stark way that there is Republicans are going into that decision with their eyes wide open. They know what they're getting with Donald Trump at this point.
I think some of them are going in with their eyes wide open, and some of them are going in with their eyes very firmly averted.
Well,
they really don't want to look too closely at all of this, right? Because then they might have to comment on it or deal with it.
That's true. I mean, the fact is that no one can say that they didn't know. And if you're not sure, pick up this book and see how see what the people around him, his closest advisors, have to say about how they were worried that Trump was a danger to this country.
Yes. And as a former Republican Congressman mm-hmm. Nia Love says, you know, when your book came out, pointed out that things were more ugly than we thought. I mean, if you read this account, if you've watched the videos, you know what's going on, and it is frightening. The book is Frankly, We Did Win This Election, The Inside Story of How Trump Lost by Michael Bender. It is an outstanding read, putting in context everything that happened last year. It was really 2020, I think, is going to go down in history as one of the most remarkable years, not just in politics, but just the intersection of everything that was happening on the streets, Black Lives Matter, the pandemic. It all happened in one year, and it really hit me reading your book, which is just an immensely compelling read. And there are a number of books coming out. Some of them are excellent. Some of them, like Michael Wolff, I would strongly recommend this book by Michael Bender. So you don't have to comment on this, but it's mm-hmm. also just much better written than Michael Wolff's book. I don't know why people are reading that stuff either. But
Charlie, I just appreciate that so much. I mean, I put so much. This is it's a story about 2020, but it's informed by my experiences from 5 years of covering Trump day in and day out, and writing this book during a pandemic. The pandemic upended all of our lives, right? Routines changed for all of us, and I asked the people around me that I love the most to shoulder even more of my own burden while I wrote this. So the reception that it's gotten so far has just been so gratifying. I'm so appreciative that you took the time to read it and that you liked it even more. Thank you very, very much.
Well, I not only read it, I devoured it. I found it impossible to put down. And also, again, I really appreciated the context that you put everything in this remarkable year. And this is not easy to do this. So this is definitely, there are a lot of books out there. I strongly recommend this. Michael, thank you for being so generous with your time today.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.